Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Send Mum Club podcast. I am Gemma, your host. Thank you for choosing to listen and welcome along. This is the parenting podcast with a difference if this is your first time listening, because yes, it is all about parenting, but it is about parenting our gorgeous children with Send in all its forms. So all kind of additional needs and disabilities, whatever that looks like for you. And I often say this on the podcast, because what I tend to find by speaking to the people that I talk to on this podcast is that although a diagnosis or a disability might be different, it brings up a lot of the same emotions and challenges and joys, because overall, I want this podcast to be a positive space, but also an honest and real space where we can talk about the things that don't feel great and the things that are hard, and the fact that obviously it looks different to how you might have thought that it would look like being a parent. So the week of recording, we are into December. Christmas is officially go, and I don't know about you, but I'm already exhausted. I've got so many lovely plans with people, you know, catching up with friends before Christmas, taking the kids to do stuff, making sure that the baby is, I say the baby, by the way, if it's your first time listening, Leo's three, but he will always be the baby to me. Trying to take him to do stuff, you know, Christmassy things. But actually what I've decided, what I've realised as well, is he isn't quite there yet. I think he has just started to be able to say the word presents. So anytime you give him anything now, we got our house valued today and the woman handed me some information leaflets. He took them and went presents. So my Christmas is going to be cheap if he thinks that housing information leaflets are presents. That's great. But I just don't think he's there in terms of understanding about Father Christmas and what it all means. And I had big grand plans to do all these things and take him to all these places and, you know, go and see Santa and these Christmas experiences. And I suddenly thought, do you know what? There's so much on. I've been super busy with work. Let's just give myself a bit of grace here. It doesn't have to look like how it looks on other people's Instagrams. And he doesn't actually completely understand what's going on. So I will run myself ragged next Christmas instead when he does understand what's going on. So enough about that. I want to talk to you about this episode. So this is a chat that actually has been in the works for a while. Today's guest is Lucy Dosser. Now, Lucy is somebody that I met through the Down Syndrome Liverpool group a while ago. In fact, ages ago when Leo was a baby, because she runs an amazing project in Liverpool, which she talks about in this episode. And oh my God, how this actually came to be a reality for her is such a beautiful story. It made me cry when she told me, and you'll hear that in this episode. But that's where I met her. And since I started the podcast, I've thought I need to get Lucy on. Firstly, because she's great and I love her view on life and on specifically on Down syndrome, but also because her son Dan is 20. And I haven't yet had a conversation on this podcast with a mum of a child who isn't really a child anymore, because Dan is a grown up. You know, he's 20. He's a young man now. And I think that conversation looks extremely different, doesn't it, to the conversation of, you know, me talking to you about my Leo, who's three, or somebody else talking about their child. It doesn't have to be with Down syndrome, but who's six. And in this episode, I was really grateful to Lucy for being so open. We do go back to her story about when Dan was born, obviously, but we also talk about logistical things like where Dan lives, what the options were for him, what they're thinking about for the future in terms of housing and what will work for Dan and their family. We talk about friendship groups and social lives and what that looks like now for Dan as a young adult. Lucy talks a little bit about growing up with Dan's siblings. He has two sisters, and what that looked like when his younger sister started to do things that Dan couldn't do yet, and how that dynamic worked. Basically, this chat is super interesting. I'm delighted I finally got Lucy on the pod, and I really hope that you're going to enjoy it and also take as much away from it as I have. I feel like this has actually given me quite a lot of thinking to do. Oh, and also, it's quite an emotional one as well. I do just need to say before we start that Lucy's audio isn't the best quality, but I promise you it's worth it. Okay, here we go. Let's get into it. Lucy, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Gemma. Nice to be here.
Now, I've wanted you on, as you know, for ages. And one of the reasons being because you have a lived experience that none of my previous guests on this podcast have got, because your child that you're here to talk about isn't actually a child at all, is he anymore?
He's not at all. He's 20.
So your Daniel is lovely. I've met him. And I met him only briefly, but I met him when Leo was, God, like a baby, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And it was really cute. There's such a lovely picture of Daniel holding Leo, isn't there? Because I remember you said he loves babies.
Yeah, it was a special day that I think Leo was like not too far off one. He was somewhere, you know.
Yeah, he was definitely, he was like a proper baby. I still call him a baby now, but he was an actual baby.
Yeah, he was proper being held in the arms.
Yeah.
And it was a special day because it was the first day in my garden project, which is a therapeutic garden project that at that point had probably been running for about 7 years, but it was the first event that we'd done with Down Syndrome Liverpool, I think.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just assumed that was something you did all the time.
No, and we have had participants and people with Down Syndrome and learning disabilities, but it was the first collab with DSL.
Aww.
And it was just a special moment because my Dan came to the garden with my other two kids, his older and younger sister. And, oh, it was just really emotional for me. And he did bond with all the babies. But we, as you say, we've got this amazing picture of him with cradling Leo, haven't we? And they just, they just bonded. And it was always forever after. Baby Leo this, baby Leo that. And some of the others. So when we see them, we still call them, well, like you said, we still call them baby so-and-so, even though they might be running around. But yeah, it was a really special moment for me as well. Yeah.
So I've accepted that I'm going to cry in this recording because
I know
we were talking on message before we started, and there was, I just think the way that you view things, I just absolutely love. But let's start by going back to the beginning. So as you've probably gathered from listening, Daniel has Down syndrome. Same as my Leo. So that was what? He was born 20 years ago?
Yeah, he was born in 2005.
And just talk me through a little bit of your start with Daniel, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I was saying to you, I'm probably going to cry as well, because I felt like when you sent me a few questions and I started thinking about it and we were messaging, and of course, going back to when he was little, I just thought, oh my God, I haven't thought about these years for ages. And I do remember when you all came into the garden, I felt really emotional as well. And I think it's just that thing of you, you know, being taken back in time and remembering some of the challenges and the joys, you know, of that time. So yeah, we'll be excused for crying. So yeah, I mean, we, like yourself, I think we didn't know, we hadn't had any tests done. It was our second child, so my eldest was about two, and I was a geriatric mum.
However,
I was like 35 or 6 or whatever. 36, yeah, something like that. And we decided not to get the test done because we thought, would it change our behaviour if we got a positive diagnosis or an indication? And we thought, no, we wouldn't. So we just decided not to get any tests done. So we didn't know till he was born. And it was kind of funny because I think, so the first night when he was born, I could tell he had Down syndrome immediately. Paul had no idea. I was going, like, the nurse was, or the midwife or whatever, was pottering. And I was saying to Paul, I think he's got Down syndrome. And he was like, no, I don't think so. And I was like, no, he definitely has. And then the nurse came over and was like, ooh, just get the doctor in then. I was like, yeah, he definitely has. Anyway, long story short, they obviously confirmed that diagnosis, and we spent the whole of that night. Oh, and they also checked his heart over, because they said like 60-odd% of babies with Down syndrome are born with a congenital heart defect. So we spent that first night in the hospital, and they let Paul stay over with me, saying, do you know what? It's fine. He's got Down syndrome. We don't know what that entails. We don't know anything about it. I didn't know anyone, I don't think. Don't think I knew anyone, like in family or extended family or whatever, with Down syndrome. Don't know anything about it, but at least he hasn't got a heart defect. He's, you know, as far as we know, healthy, and that's more what matters. So we spent the whole of the first night just, we didn't, I don't know if it's strange, but we didn't feel that, like, affected by it. I mean, we were affected by it, but we didn't feel, like, devastated or anything like that. And then the next day, they did a scan on him, because that is standard. I'm guessing Leo had a scan as well, and found that he did indeed have a double hole in the heart. So then the second night, now that was the blow. And I do remember coming out of the neonatal, you know, the unit in the women's where he'd had the scan. And we hadn't seen the consultant, but obviously when they'd done the scan, they, you know, you can see the two holes. And I remember standing around this, me and Paul standing around this plastic bassinet in the middle of a really busy corridor in the women's, people going past. And it's like everything disappeared and we were in this little bubble. And that is the first, possibly the only time I've ever seen Paul cry. Maybe he's cried once. I honestly can't remember any other point that he's cried, because he was probably brought up in that way. Boys don't cry and stuff. And we both just cried around this plastic bassinet.
Okay, well, we've got seven minutes in, Lucy, and we're both in tears.
I know, because I've got a cold. I've got a very unglamorous bog roll. So it's not very Hollywood Housewives, is it? Anyway.
It was stupidly, I've bought nothing, and I was aware that this was going to happen. I thought I might get further than seven minutes, but, you know, we move. God.
You might have to use the dog, Gemma. Yeah, so that was the blow for us. And when I reflect on it, that was the hardest thing over the first, say, 5 years, was the heart condition. And, you know, the whole, you do literally go into a bubble. You go into a hospital bubble, and they can't operate straight away, or they don't like to, so they will operate on newborns if they're going to die. But with the hole in the heart, they try to leave it as late as possible. But it's a balancing act, because if you leave it too long, they can get long-term lung damage. So, yeah, so I think, so we went into the bubble, and I'd say life didn't really kind of normalize again for me in terms of, like, work and other elements to life until maybe sort of 4 or 5 years later.
Oh, wow. How old was he when he had the surgery?
So he was 7 months, but like, you know, like everything else, which I would probably put money on, every single person watching this podcast who has a child with any kind of disability or learning disability, this will resonate with them, that you have to kind of, you have to really fight every step of the way for everything. And not only that, but you have to even get ginned up on everything. So nobody really tells you anything, do they? You know, other parents do, and this isn't a criticism against, like, healthcare professionals or any other type of professionals, but right from that moment, it always, like, shocked me that there's not more accessible routes to care and provision and whatever. And it all started there. So the operation too late, he can get lung damage too early, he's too small, and the risks of the operation are higher. So it was that balancing act. So around 7 months is when they start to worry, you know, it roughly about lung damage. So 7 months came and he was given a hospital date. And then because ICU, the intensive care, is always oversubscribed, always, for any child. And Dan was born in September, which the midwife really helpfully said to me, not our midwife, a midwife said, he was born at the wrong time of year, because he was born when the respiratory diseases were at their height, September to March. And so you have to, so basically we were, I mean, it was poor, because we were took into a little room after this scan, and a doctor drew a little pencil drawing of the chambers of the heart and said, this is what your child's got. He's got a hole here and a hole here. And what we need to do is this, this, this. He'll have an operation when the time is right. You'll see the consultant, la, la, la. And he said, he was like, so any questions? I mean, that had took about 5 minutes. And we were like, yeah. And he said, you don't need to worry about anything. He said, basically, if he turns blue, bring him into A&E. And we were like, what, are you literally kidding? And that was kind of it. And we were sent home, like, desperately Googling. Can't even remember if Google was a thing back then. So I'm not even, yeah, anyway. So you had those months of trying to keep him away from infection with an older child in the respiratory season, with everyone sneezing and coughing. And people have been more familiar with that now post-COVID, but that was like our mini COVID. We were like, I mean, I became a bit, I've never been a germaphobe in any way, but I did become quite obsessed with keeping him away from stuff. And anyway, so then he got a date. And the day before his operation, there was a car accident. Family of children, and they were in intensive care. And that's what the NHS is dealing with, because they don't have the resources. So the children who were at risk, you know, we're in there. So it wasn't the surgeon, it wasn't the operating theatre, it was the intensive care bed afterwards. So then we didn't know when the next date would be, and basically at that point, I mean, I don't know what you're like, but I'm a researcher, so when I've got a problem or an issue, I do gen up on it. And I won't remember a lot of it now, but I did become deeply informed about this heart condition, and I was part of the Down's Heart group, which was a great support, and lots of other forums and groups. And basically we had to fight for the operation, and that was really hard, because you don't want to say, like, my kid should come before someone else, but your duty as his parent is to push for his care. So it was writing letters saying, you know, he needs to get his operation soon, otherwise the risk of lung damage is big, and that has a huge effect on the rest of their lives, their health for the rest of their lives. So anyway, he did get his operation. I can't even remember how much longer than that it was, but he did get it, and it was successful, very successful. He had an amazing surgeon called Dr. Potsey, who practiced all over the world. We are so lucky to have Alder Hey on our doorstep. And we had the most incredible care there. It was like, could not be bettered. It was incredible. He had the op, and it all went really well. We did have health issues after that because he developed reflux, which is really common post-surgery, particularly cardiac surgery. And I will just say now, I won't go into all that, but just to briefly say, if your baby does not settle within, you know, weeks or a couple of months of surgery, there is something wrong. And you may, like me, be told that there's nothing wrong. So basically, after surgery, this is my cold as well, by the way. I'm not crying again. after surgery, Dan, he didn't sleep. So prior to surgery, I had to feed him every between hour and a half and 2 hours. So I woke him up through the night for a feed because he had to be, his weight got up for the surgery. After surgery, he woke every between, 50 minutes and an hour. He was waking within about an hour and he was only settling with a feed and he was screaming. And at first it was just like recovery from surgery and blah, blah, blah. And then as it continued, I was thinking there's something wrong here. And I looked into it and I thought, oh, I think he's got reflux. It's pretty obvious. Like the feed would settle him because it basically gets them to swallow down and it soothes the pain that they've got. And the way he was waking up and screaming and being soothed by that feed, I knew that it was reflux. And I went to Alderhay and I saw the cardiac nurses and I saw the gastro department, one of the gastric practitioners. And they said, I described what was happening. And by this point, it's probably 3 months in and I'd not had more than an hour's sleep at a time.
Oh my God, you must have been exhausted.
I was totally exhausted, completely exhausted following 7 months of waking every 2 hours. And they said, do you know what? Don't think he's got reflux. And I was like, but based on ABC, and they were like, yeah, I don't think he's got it, but get some infant Gaviscon and give him that. And if that settles it, that means it is reflux. So maybe come back and see us or just keep giving him the infant Gaviscon. I gave him the infant Gaviscon and it didn't make any difference whatsoever. So I thought, oh my God, I was wrong. It wasn't that. What else could it be? He'd always been a great sleeper. You know, it was me waking him up, not him waking me up. And anyway, 18 months later, Gemma, 18 months of waking every hour to feed him, I had been researching and I found through another parent, and I can't remember who it was, but this is how we get our information. I found the UK specialist on Down syndrome and gastric conditions, Patrick, and I can't remember his surname, it might come back to me, Patrick, Dr. Patrick, someone in Manchester, and his son's got Down syndrome, and that's why he ended up as a gastric specialist consultant. He ended up specializing in Down syndrome, and I requested to see him, and I went to Manchester, and I spent about 5 minutes telling him what had happened, maybe even two, and he went, of course he's got gastric reflux. Of course he has. And he then prescribed me infant Gaviscon and omeprazole. Infant Gaviscon is not enough. And I gave Dan that night and it stopped.
Wow.
And I did put in a complaint and I was invited to come and see a panel of nurses and gastro practitioners and consultants. And I said to them, look, there's no going back, but 18 months of waking every hour. And the thing is, when I came to see you and I knew what it was, and you not only told me I was wrong, which probably wouldn't have put me off, but you gave me some evidence by saying, give him that. And if it doesn't, and after that, I just lost my confidence. in my own opinion and my own instinct. So it was like doubly damaging, and that's why I put up with it for so long. And by the end of that, like, I was literally a mess. Like, bear in mind, I had a daughter as well, you know? I couldn't just sleep all day. I mean, I did obviously sleep. Well, I couldn't, because Dan would still wake up. I just remembered the actual details of it, you know? So I just said to them, look, I don't... what's done is done, but please never, ever do this to anyone else. And they, you know, apologised profusely, and they assured me as individuals that they would never let that happen again. So there.
And your instincts were right.
They were right. They were dead right.
I'd be interested to know what your experience is, Lucy, because I've heard Ellie Goldstein's mum talk about this, and her and Dan are similar ages. Is Ellie like 21 maybe? Is she a tiny bit older than Dan?
Yeah, I think so.
So I've heard her mum, like anything that they go on, I watch or listen to or whatever, and I've heard her mum recently on a podcast talking about the way in which I think it was a nurse spoke to her when Ellie was born, which is just, it's horrible to listen to. And I think it's more horrible when you consider that actually it's not that long ago that these kind of outdated ideas were still around. Like, she basically said that a nurse came in and said to her, do you want to just leave her here? Because I'm quoting her here. These aren't my words. These are the words she said that the nurse said. The last time somebody had one of them, they left it here. Do you want to do that?
Oh,
which is just horrific. But what was your experience of kind of how, well, I guess people around you and also society reacted when they found out that Dan had Down syndrome?
Well, first of all, that's probably like one of the most shocking things I've ever heard.
It's awful, isn't it?
I mean, we will all have had things said at multiple times through our children's lives that are just not right, completely off the mark, misinformed, ignorant, whatever. But that's something else. That feels like that's not a person that should be in healthcare.
No, of course not.
You know, even if they're misinformed, it's like, so I think it's a tough one, that, because first of all, I do often think back at different stages in Dan's life. I've often thought back to parents, even 35, 40 years ago, like, and certainly prior to that, where it is not that long ago that our kids would, most of children born as our children would be in institutions, locked away. And we know from how our kids are that if we'd locked Leo or Dan in an institution since they were babies, they would become vegetables, because they reflect so much, they absorb so much, they are so in the moment of their lives and the world, that to not have any input, it's damaging to any child, but particularly, I think, maybe damaging to them. So I do often think back, and then that's the extreme, but then even just having, you know, those parents that had to struggle to get them into mainstream education, parents before the heart surgery was developed, you know, all those things. So on the one hand, I think we have to, or it might help us to focus on the positive aspects. And I don't know if we're typical or not, but I've very rarely had, I've had lots of weird exchanges, not to that extent, but I've never kind of felt, when I'm going around with Dan, very rarely have I not felt accepted. And it has happened once or twice, and it's been really, like, so jarring, but that's because it never happens. I don't know if we're typical or that's just us, but I think early on we had some really misplaced comments made from I mean, really highly misplaced from people close to us and people, you know, in hospitals and whatever. And I think dead early on, me and Paul just said, do you know what? We're not going to, people are going to have their view and it's going to be based on loads of factors and layered stuff that's nothing to do with us and nothing to do with Daniel. And maybe we just don't engage with that. Maybe we just put it outside of what we're doing and thinking. Now, obviously, if it was someone like, I don't know, a teacher or, you know, someone we were dealing with every day, we would address it. So, yeah, I mean, that's different. What you just said about what that person said in the hospital, that's completely unforgivable. And I would be on a campaign if, do you know what I mean? If that had been said to me in the hospital, that's shocking.
Yeah, but I think, see, I agree with you. And I was horrified. I mean, you know, I was horrified on behalf of her as a mom who's just had a baby and that's been said to her. I was horrified from, you know, my own personal feelings, obviously, because my son also has Down syndrome. So that made me feel a certain kind of way. But then when I think about it, though, that, I mean, obviously this was a long time ago and you would hope to God that nobody would say that now and shouldn't have done then. But it's almost backed up by the abortion law, though, isn't it? Because the law states that if you know that your child has Down syndrome, you can choose to abort up until they're in the birth canal, which is reinforcing that idea of this life isn't worth living. This is going to be terrible. So you can choose at any point in your pregnancy to stop that happening. And that, I think, is the thing for me. That's the thing that gets me when I really think about that. And I cannot get my head around how in 2025, that law hasn't changed. And people have recently tried to change that law. They went to Parliament to change the law and they said no. It's things like that, I think, that stop things moving forward, because it is validating almost those outdated views, isn't it?
Yeah, it's making a statement. And I mean, it is really complex, but one of the, I don't want to say advantages, but so one of the things about Down syndrome is it is a visible, testable, quantifiable, you know, condition, learning disability. There are many, many others which are not testable, visible, quantifiable in that way. And as a parent, Down syndrome is not necessarily going to cause you any more or fewer issues than many other learning disabilities that wouldn't be picked up. Or for that matter, like, I think one of the reasons we weren't devastated is because we never had expectations of what being a parent or having a child would be. What is it with a typical child? What's typical childhood? What's typical child like? I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, I feel bringing up a child and an adult, because we are going to be caring for our children until we are not here anymore, and then we have to make sure that they are cared for after that, which with Dan at 20, this is where our minds are now, is how to navigate all that. But there's no guarantees for anyone, and it can be very challenging, as can having any child, as can having a child with, you know, a mental health condition or a physical disability or a health condition or, like, living in poverty or being in a situation of domestic abuse with a child or children. Like, there's no... So I completely, you know, going back to what you were saying about the abortion law, you know, that's the thing. What are we saying with that? That there's some kind of concept of a perfect baby, perfect child, perfect person, human. I just think it's all rubbish. And I do believe in that we should have abortion. You know, I believe in abortion laws, but
yeah. The
fact that it's different for a child with Down syndrome, as you're saying, is really highly questionable. And it's, you know, when we look at countries like, is it Iceland, which is the country that has kind of banned Down syndrome? Is it Iceland?
I think it might be. I think that I think what you're referring to is they're like, oh, we've eliminated it. And that's through prenatal testing, isn't it?
Yeah. So they've tested it out of existence. So they've made that abortion law obligatory, mandatory. I think you can choose to go against it, but then you would get no care, you'd get no health care, no provision. Da, da, da. And I think that abortion law is kind of a slippery slope to something like that, because you are saying this is not a desirable characteristic, let's get rid of it.
You mentioned about caring for Dan and the future and what that looks like. So this is a conversation, as I mentioned at the beginning, that I haven't been able to have on the podcast before, because I think the eldest child, I think, has been 17. And that was Charlotte that I spoke to about her son, who has autism, profound autism. So does Daniel live with you full time?
Yes, he does. And he's left school, so he went to mainstream primary, and then he went to special school for his secondary education. And as part of that, he got an extra year called a transition year. So he only left school like this summer just gone. And he spent that year doing a supported internship. So that was a really good kind of bridge between school and not school. And in fact, for him, it did lead on to other opportunities. So I think it's quite shocking how little information you're given as a parent about navigating anything past school. I mean, it's really unacceptable. And it's really hard to figure out why it is either, because there are certain choices and provisions and, you know, opportunities and services that you can access. There's not that many of them, so it's not that hard for a council to kind of sum them all up. But basically, I'd say moving into the adult world has been a bit like, I sort of feel like it's like someone giving you directions where to go, and they give you like Google Maps on a phone. So they do like, you know, it's not like they just leave you nothing at all. Give you Google Maps on a phone, but they put a blindfold on you. And then you've got to find your way. That's how it's felt. It's felt like every step you've got to like ask for everything and work it out and get on Google and talk to other parents, like piece it together, and you're like, why? And then once you actually get some support, you're kind of given a booklet and you're like, for God's sake, I know all that now. Like, just give me that at the start of the process, like a year before he was leaving school, basically. So that is really frustrating, and There's loads of stuff that's been difficult around it. But, you know, Dan's really happy and we've got things set up for him to do. He does live with us, and I can't see that changing any time soon. And it's funny because I think the weirdest thing as they get older and like they get to puberty and past that, you know, and all that is, yes, he is an adult, he's a young adult, and he has all the sort of, he wants to do all the things that, you know, young adults or teenagers would do, and he wants to have independence from his parents and all that. But at the same time, he is still like a child in so many ways. And that is quite hard to navigate, I would say. Because I think particularly, so Daniel's pretty high functioning. He's got good communication skills, got good cognitive skills. He can read and write, that type of thing. So he's pretty high functioning. He's extremely intelligent, very high emotional intelligence, etc. And I think people that get to know him see that he's very competent. However, and you never want to kind of go, oh, yes, but, like, yeah, but he's not. You don't want to, like, take away from that. But at the same time, he is like a child. Like, he's rung me this morning to ask how can he get the bagels out of the packet. Like, it's literally a plastic packet of bagels, you know. And I nipped up to work to open up and asked him to get some breakfast. And he's like, rings me up to say, how do I open the bagel packet? So it's like he needs constant reassurance. And the whole, whenever I meet up, so he's in various clubs and sessions and whatever. And whenever I talk to other parents of adults with Down syndrome or learning disabilities, the conversation is always the same. Like, it's our concerns now are about where will they live, you know, when and if they no longer want to live with us, and how will we manage that, and how will we support them, and how can we make them feel and have genuine independence while still protecting them because they are vulnerable, etc., etc. And I definitely feel like when Dan was a baby, I just felt like, I'm going to protect you forever. I just, you know, we're here. Just everything's fine. We'll be fine. We'll do whatever it takes. And we're a team. We're a family. So it's hard because I think when they're little, you just have it in your head that you're always going to be there for them. And when you have to engage with that might not be what they want now. And then secondly, you're not going to be here forever. It's complex.
I've managed to go there in my head with the living situation for Leo. We've kind of got a little plan at the minute. We're actually, don't know if I should say it because I don't want to jinx it, but we've just looked at a house, which is like a full reno, which terrifies me. But we've looked at a house which has, I don't want to say a garage because it's so much bigger than that. But in the garden, it's got like a little, what you could make into a self-contained little, not house, but you know what I mean, where he could live there, have his own space that was separate from our house, but he is very much under our care still if he wasn't able to live, you know, away from us. So I've kind of been able to go there. And I think that feels nice in my head because obviously, like you said, you want them to have independence as an adult, but there's a lot of other things to take into consideration, which I get. I think, and I know a lot of other parents can't yet go there with the what happens when we're not here, and I can't. And that's fine. I'm giving myself grace with that.
Well,
I'm like,
I
okay,
can't
well,
either.
I don't need to go there yet.
I can't go there either.
Yeah,
it's hard. I mean, what you've just said is what we would love to do. We're not really in a position to do that now, but I have been keeping my eye out because buying a place where he could have independent living attached to us is exactly what we'd like to do, and it's been done in our family with somebody else. And it works well. You know, they have their own flat, but they are attached. So I think that is probably the way we'll go. But then again, you know, I don't know if I will ever have the energy for this, but I have had theoretical conversations with other parents. I would like to set up, or I would like there to be some kind of living situation locally that, you know, sort of social enterprise, parent-led or families, lived experience-led housing solution. Not necessarily communal living, but, you know, like a sort of housing co-op or whatever. Because all the good ones that I've found like that, they're not here. They're not where we live. It is hard. And for me, I couldn't foresee him ever living alone really as such because, like, I've only lived alone once or twice in my life, and I didn't like it. Like, it's, I think we are, you know, some people like living alone, but most people, like, we're social animals, and we, you know, we our instinct is to live with others, and I don't think our kids are any different to anyone else in that sense.
Do you know, because there's certain things I'm happy to Google and certain things I'm scared to Google, and this is one of the things that I'm scared to Google. Do you know of any adults who do live completely independently who have Down syndrome?
I think I do. And the reason I say that is because I don't know exactly the setup, because I don't see this person very often. But amongst people that I see regularly, no. But to be honest, I don't know that many older adults with Down syndrome. Like, most of the people I know with Down syndrome are around Dan's age, and none of them are living independently. So the people that I know would either be living with family or living in a shared accommodation type, you know, a kind of supported housing type of setup.
Well, I suppose it's because of Dan's age, though. I think when I was growing up, and where I grew up was in the middle of nowhere, literally the middle of nowhere. And now that's the kind of place you go, oh my God, I'd love to go away, and, you know, no phone signal, nothing around for the weekend and escape. But growing up, it's literally the worst thing in the world, and I was desperate to leave. So I moved out when I was 17. But I think certainly living in a city where you do have everything you need and there's so much going on, and the way that house prices are and jobs and everything, I don't think there's probably many 20-year-olds in general across the board who aren't living at home. So I suppose at the minute you're not really in an unusual situation in any way, are you? Because I would, you know, my eldest is 17. I would assume that he will, I'm hoping he'll go to uni, but I would assume that when he comes back, he'll probably move back in with us.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think where it'll kick in with Daniel is when my youngest, who's 15, so my eldest is away at uni, and she will probably move in just for a short while, but I don't think she'll ever live with us long term again, unless she completely has to. Not because she doesn't like us, just because once you've had your own place, you know, that's what you want. But I think when his younger sister leaves home, and whenever that is, you know, whether she's 30 or 20 or whatever, I think that'll be a really difficult point for Daniel. So already, you know, this has happened all his life, that his younger sister overtook him in everything very quickly, whether it was walking or, you know, talking or writing or going to college or anything. So when that happens, I think that'll be really difficult for him, because he will feel, I'm the older one, I shouldn't still be here. That will be complicated. And I think that's why some kind of living arrangement like what you said would be ideal, because it would probably give him the sense that he was independent without the reality of it.
Did that bother him growing up when his younger sister started to do things that he wasn't doing?
I don't think it bothered him when he was younger, because they were like two little peas in a pod, like they were just joined at the hip, and he just thought everything she did was fantastic. So I don't think it bothered him in that way. But now that he's older, so she's just got her first boyfriend, and I know that's hard for him. I think the hardest thing for us right now is the social side. And that really has probably been the hardest thing since leaving primary as well. He's really sociable, but he's never really had, even in primary, he's never really had friendships like everyone else has friendships. And, you know, at his age 20 now, he wants to be going out with his mates, with young people. He wants to be going out and, you know, going to bars and clubs, and he wants to meet, you know, a girlfriend and have those experiences. And he's not. And he does have social experiences, but what we've always done is we've used... Dan is very dramatic. He has always been into performing. He loves theatre and, you know, acting and drama. That's like his thing. That's always been his big passion. And so we've been able to join him up to youth theatres and drama groups. And that has been absolutely invaluable, because when he would go to youth theatre, for him, that was going out and hanging with his mates. It was a social experience for him, and it made up for the fact that he wasn't getting that in other areas of his life. Now he's not, he's obviously too old for youth theatre, but he's still, so he goes to a sort of a disability arts group that do theatre shows, and he's working now 2 days a week with that theatre company as well. So he does have more social outlets still through work and through the clubs that he's part of, but he still doesn't really have genuine, you know, proper friendships, and he certainly has never yet, you know, I won't say he hasn't had opportunity, because he probably has had opportunity, but he hasn't met anyone, you know, he hasn't clicked with anyone yet. So, yeah, I think when his younger sister overtakes him in those respects, I think that is hard for him. But I don't think it was when he was younger. In fact, it really helped to bring him on. She really helped to bring him on, because he was always trying to do what she was doing.
Said to me in a message before we jumped on the recording that having Dan and him having Down syndrome changed the whole direction of your life. How so?
So I'd had my daughter 2 years before, and I was working in film and television. I was doing like location shoots, 6 day weeks, God knows 16-hour days, or so God knows how many hours days, that very all-encompassing type of career. When I had my daughter, or when I got pregnant with her, I stopped doing location shoots and I went to more office-based work, but in the same sector. And that was fine. And she went into nursery, and I was able to keep that up. And then when I had Dan, as I said before, I was just thrown that, you know, I was in doing a shoot in a studio 2 days before he was born. And then all of a sudden I'm like, it's hospitals and intensive care and da 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 and scans and la la la. So I think when I sort of came out of the bubble, which was very gradual because of all that long time of the gastric stuff, and then it took me a while to recover from that. So I'd say it was probably about 4 years. I did start dipping my toe in stuff with my old work and with my husband's work, but really I was not working for about 4 years. And then when I came back to it, I just found that I didn't want to go back into that industry. I just wanted to change, and it had been shaped a little bit by a sort of experience that I'd had in the hospital. It was just there in the back of my mind, which was, it was really weird, because that first night when we were just, you know, we only knew about the Down syndrome, and we were just sort of saying, it's fine, we'll look after him and we'll do this and we'll, you know, I had this vision, with like a visual experience, which is unusual for me because I don't think in images. I normally think in more in words and narrative. And I just had this image like that kept coming and going all through the night, the evening and the night, which was of just a kind of garden with green, just green everywhere, lush, high, not walls, but like almost walls of vegetation. And it was a garden, and me and Daniel were in it, and he was older, and we were just picking stuff and, you know, being there with all the bees and the bird song and whatever. And it was really unusual for me to think in that way. I've never before or since had a vision like that. And I didn't say anything to Paul. You know, we had lots going through our minds and we were talking, but also being in our own selves as well. And then the next day I told him about it and he went, "Oh my God, that's so weird." He said, "I had a vision of," he said, "I can only describe it as the bend in the road." And he said there was like a road, and then at the end of it, there was like these old pillars, like sandstone pillars or whatever. And you could tell beyond it was this gorgeous garden. And you and Dan, he was grown up, and you were stood with a little table and you were selling produce. And we were like, what? How could we literally have such a similar experience? And he's like, I did have an allotment. I'd had my allotment for 4 or 5 years by then. But he'd never sown a seed, picked a bean. Like, he had no reason to have that dream at all. So that was just like there in the back of my head. And then, you know, long story short, I just thought, I want to get into something else. I tried a lot of things, tried volunteering, you know, I was volunteering in schools. I did some training in social and therapeutic horticulture and ended up setting up the garden that I run now, which is a therapeutic garden, and it's all around connecting people to nature. And the beautiful irony is that our Daniel, who I was going to keep safe in this green oasis sanctuary, is just like, "Mum, your mud, your sticks, your whatever, your garden." He's like all about the drama. And he knows what my old job was, and he's just like, "Oh, so pathetic. Why would you leave that industry and start like gardening?" But I kind of love that. I love that. So he's now, you know, he's got a job with a theatre company. He's been in about 6 or 7 main house productions. He lives to do all that. And I have not pushed him into that whatsoever, but I have been able to create more opportunities for him, I guess, because I've known about them a bit more. I love that.
Do you know what's so nice though? Because that made me cry when you told me about your vision. Because Lucy, when I met you, you were stood in that garden and Daniel was next to you and he was older. Like, I met you literally in the vision that you had when he was born.
That is so funny. I can't believe it.
That's incredible. That's so beautiful. I love that so much, that, you know, you created something that came to you because of him.
Yeah. And you know, I'm pretty sure you found exactly the same. Having Daniel reprioritized everything in life for me, you know, it kind of, don't get me wrong, having all my children, all three of my children did, having children reframed life for me in really brilliant ways. But particularly having Daniel did. It just, you know, I feel like he's brought so much into our lives in terms of, you know, just adapting, being resilient, just trying. I mean, I don't manage this like he does, but trying to live in the moment more, because that is definitely like his superpower, is he lives in the moment, and he is, if he can possibly be positive, he will be. And that is a great way to be. And, you know, it is, I do genuinely think that people spend lifetimes, like holy people and whatever, spend lifetimes trying to work out the key to life and the essence of life. And they, you know, generally one of the conclusions that they come to is you have to live in the moment. And we all know that if you have a positive aspect on life, you're going to have better experiences because of the connection. You know, the brain is such a huge power that, you know, affects everything in our physical and spiritual and mental systems, that is the way to be. And he is like that naturally. And I, you know, that has rubbed off on all of us. And so, yeah, he has, you know, I never want to like romanticize things too much, because as we talked about in the text, you know, there are a lot of challenges. I'm not going to lie. Like sometimes when I think back to when Dan was younger, not even when he was a baby, you know, when he was like absconding every place we went and everything took 100 years to, you know, kick in. But it was hard. There was a lot hard about that. But there were so many positive things as well. It did just reprioritize life for me.
Yeah, I think Leo's only 3 and he's got so much more personality to develop, obviously. But I think me and my husband Ben can clearly see things about him now that I am 100% sure are because of his Down syndrome, not in spite of it. And I think it's made more clear to me, having had 2 typical children who are older. Like, I keep saying to Ben all the time, babies and toddlers are not this well behaved. They're not this chill. They're not like, you don't understand how lucky you've got it. Because my other 2 are with my previous partner. So this is Ben's first experience of having a baby and being a dad. I mean, he's a stepdad, but being a dad to a brand new baby. I like to think, I mean, not for Leo, but people with Down syndrome who are older and experiences that I hear about and read about, I like to think that it's contentment. And that's ultimately what everyone's striving for, isn't it? Because the natural way that we live in our society, I always think, and I am so guilty of this, it's unbelievable. I'm like a marketing dream. You constantly go, well, when I've got this, things will be better. Like, once I've got this, I'll feel happier. And when I've achieved this, then things will be great. And not that I'm not happy now, but you know what I mean? You're constantly, we're in a society where you're constantly striving for something else or wanting something else. And what you've got is never quite enough. And I think, like you said, what a beautiful way for your brain to work, to not be doing that all the time. And just be like, yeah, great. Yeah. Fine as I am.
Completely. I mean, Dan often walks in from work or wherever he's been and says, I love my life, Mum.
Oh.
That's like probably the little thing that he says to me the most, apart from, Mum, question.
But what more could you want for your kids, though, than for them to say that and really, really believe that? Because I think what I struggled with and what I had to work through in therapy quite a bit was, I think the things that made me feel sad about Leo's diagnosis were actually nothing to do with Leo. They were all to do with my perceptions and my expectations and hopes in my head. And really what I worked through and got to at the bottom of it was, you just want them to be happy, and their happy doesn't have to look like what you thought it would look like. And it doesn't have to look like what would make you happy. Or somebody else happy. It has to look like what makes them happy.
Completely. 100%. That's really well put. Yeah.
It's hard though. There's still bits of me. There's still kinks to work out. But it's an ongoing process, isn't it? I think acceptance, I've come to realise, is not a linear process. And it's fine to have bumps and fine to feel sad and feel disappointed about something or upset or triggered. But it doesn't mean that I wish things were different. They're just moments of it, maybe. And that's okay.
Exactly. Yeah, And all parenthood is a roller coaster anyway.
Like, oh, listen, when my older two are playing up, I'm like, oh my God, I wish things were different. Exactly. Right, Lucy, I finished the podcast in the same way with each of my guests with the same two questions. So the first question is, what's the best piece of advice that you've been given along the way?
Well, I was thinking about this when you texted it through. It's probably because it's such a long time ago now, but I feel like I don't know if I was given that much advice. I probably was given a lot of advice and didn't listen to it at all. But I feel like it's the two things that people have said to me that sort of resonated with me the most. And it's funny because one's really pragmatic and one's a bit more kind of mystical or something. So when we were in the hospital that first night, there was a gorgeous midwife called Flo. She was, you know, probably not far off retirement back then. And she came in with a cup of tea for us both because they let Paul stay overnight. Which
I was going to say, not you and the baby. That wouldn't be right.
A little whiskey for him in his bottle. And she came in with a cup of tea and she said, I'm just going off shift now. She said, but I just wanted to tell you that they're only given to special people. Kids, babies like yours are only given to special people. And it was so funny because I think me and Paul are quite like, you know, pragmatic people. I wouldn't normally kind of respond to something like that, but it really meant a lot to both of us. It was a beautiful moment, and it gave us some, because I've said that to some people and they've gone, oh God, what are we, you know, oof. But we loved it. It just felt, it was obviously meant from the heart with them. It just felt like a beautiful, special moment and gave us a lot of good feeling that night. And then the other thing, it's not advice at all, but I remember seeing a friend of mine, and I didn't have Dan with me, and I hadn't seen him since the baby was born. And he'll know who he is if he ever watches this, which is unlikely. But so I bumped into him and he said, oh, did you have the baby? And da da da. And I said, yeah. I said, Robert, he's got Down syndrome. And he said, oh, he said, what colour eyes has he got?
Oh.
And it took me a second for that to sink in. And I was like, wow, that's really beautiful, you know.
It is, because I think, obviously, it's hard. And I would have found it hard before having Leo, to know how to respond to that. And I think, like you, I had no experience of Down syndrome. I genuinely don't think I'd ever even said hello to someone with Down syndrome, because I'd never had the opportunity to. And I think, I'll be very honest, I was very ignorant to all of this before I had Leo. And I think I would have naturally gone, oh God, I'm so sorry. And how lovely that wasn't his response, because we'll all have had that. We'll all have had people going, oh, I'm so sorry. And obviously now I know that's absolutely not the right thing to say.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like, you know, and I kind of went, I mean, it was only a few weeks old. And I kind of thought, shit, what colour eyes has he got? And then, you know, and so it was just a little lesson for me to go, Down syndrome, the heart defect. Like, this is a baby with eyes of a certain colour, blue grey. Yeah. So they're not advice, but they were little comments that were useful. Important to me, yeah.
But think how many years ago that was, and they've stayed with you. How beautiful. So the last question is, what do you know now that you wish you'd known when you got Dan's diagnosis, either his Down syndrome or the heart condition?
If I could only change one thing, it would have been that experience. Well, no, sorry. If I could change one thing, he wouldn't have had a heart condition. But if I could have changed one thing after that point, it would have been that whole gastric thing. But what that comes back to is the bit of advice that I would give anyone and that includes people with a baby with Down syndrome or any baby, which is to trust your gut and never stop trusting it, because I feel like at that point in that process, because I felt like I had my strong gut instinct for what was happening there, but it was derailed by the information they presented to me. And obviously, I don't think we should, you know, we don't know better than a healthcare professional necessarily. And I'm not trying to say we should like do everything ourselves or blindly like say, I know what's best, I know what's best. But I'm just saying, like, I was following my gut, and if I had continued to do so, it would have maybe been 4 months instead of 18, and I wouldn't have been, you know, a literally walking zombie. And I'm sure that affected my health for many years. I think if I'd known one thing, I think it just would have been to trust your gut and keep trusting it.
It comes down to that thing, doesn't it, of you may not be a healthcare professional and you may not have medical training, but you know your baby best.
Yeah. And I think, and to be honest, I feel like I did know the most important thing that I believe now, which is people come in all shapes and forms, and just like everything's going to be okay in some form. You know, so everything's going to be okay. But I feel like I kind of knew that in my gut. So there you go. Back to the gut again.
I love that. And that's a lovely place to finish. Lucy, despite you making me cry multiple times, I've really, really enjoyed our chat, and I'm absolutely delighted that you came on. Thank you so much.
Oh, me too. I've been looking forward to it. I'm really pleased we got it done. It's great.
Well, I know I shouldn't have favourites, but that was one of my favourite episodes ever. I think I love Lucy anyway, although I've only met her briefly a couple of times. But it was really interesting, if you can hear that noise, by the way, the dog's on my lap and she's decided to start snoring very loudly. So sorry about that. It was really interesting for me personally, and I hope you as well, to hear what Lucy was saying about being a mum to a young man, an adult. Well, Dan is an adult. He's 20 now. And it's the first time I've been able to have those conversations really with another mum of, okay, so where does he live? How does that work? What were the options? You know, what are your challenges now? So I hope you found that as interesting as I did. I hope you loved the whole chat in general, really. And I just love Lucy's view on why Dan, as an older person with Down syndrome, you know, why he feels so content and how he lives in the moment. And just that thing she said about him coming home and saying, I love my life. I mean, that just makes me feel so emotional, because like I said to Lucy, what more could we possibly want from our children, that they come home at the end of the day and go, I love my life. What beautiful words. Love it. So that's it for another episode of the Send Mum Club. Thank you so much for listening. Before you go, I know I say it all the time, but it does help other people to find this podcast. If you could like, subscribe, review, rate, follow, and the following and the subscribing, by the way, doesn't cost anything. It just makes the podcast a little bit more visible, I think. So that would be wonderful if you could. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next time.